25% done with the material that I hope to cover in the 3 weeks course. So I'm going to just spend the last 4 days to talk about the post-inflationary universe, the CMB and large-scale structure. We won't be able to cover all of that physics, of course, but we'll just see how far we can go in 4 days. So I want to start by talking about some sort of GR foundations. So let me just start. Let's say the context is just special relativity for now. If we're interested in special relativity about talking about, say, the energy E of a particle, then the covariant way to think about that is the zero component of the four momentum P mu. So to understand how the energy transforms under Lorentz transforms, you would be forced to introduce the momentum in this whole four vector. What is, as a question, suppose you have some like a gas of particles and you're interested in its number density. If we just take a constant time snapshot and count the density of particles, what is that, what covariant object is that a piece of? There is a number current. Like this, which would just be the sum of the four momentum of all the particles divided by their rest mass. The way this generalizes, let's say this is special relativity. The way this generalizes to GR is a covariant way of thinking about this object, which is defined for any like ensemble of world lines, is that imagine that I have a little infinitesimal piece of surface, so this is a codimension one piece of surface with some normal vector n mu. And some three volume dv. If I have some ensemble of world lines, then the signed number of world lines, I want to count the number of world lines which cross the surface. That is to say, if a world line crosses in the same direction as the normal vector, it's counted as plus one. And if it goes in the opposite direction, it's counted as minus one. This is just the dot product of the normal vector of the surface with the number density current times the three volume of the surface. So this is sort of a manifestly covariant way of defining this object n mu. So a special case is if the codimension one surface is a surface of constant time, then this just says that n mu is the number of world lines per unit per three volume. And if this codimension one surface were a surface of constant x, so that it's filling in the y, z, and time directions, then this would say that the space-like components are just the count the net number of particles per unit area per unit time moving from one side of the surface to the other, the net number of world lines. That is to say their number density times v. Now here, it's useful to have a formula for this. So let's say that I have a bunch of world lines, be a set of parameterized world lines. Then here's a fancy looking covariant formula for the number density current. I sum over the world lines. For each world line, I take the integral of d tau times this delta function. This guy is like the covariant delta function. In GR, you know, the quantity d4x square root minus g transforms covariantly. This has the same value in all frames, which is why you can, integrating a scalar is a coordinate system independent quantity. And so likewise, a delta function with a minus square root g is a covariant quantity, because if I stuck it in here, I would get 1. So the coordinate dependence has to cancel. Okay, so this is manifestly covariant because I have this covariant object times this covariant object transforms as a vector. And it's even reparameterization invariant. If I reparameterize tau, I have zero total d taus. So the number density current is just defined given any set of world lines. I don't need to say anything about how they're parameterized, whether they're geodesics or anything. Okay. So I sort of figured this would be in the GR class. This wasn't in the PsyGR class. It's a really useful way. It's often useful in GR. You know, if you're thinking about quantities like the stress energy tensor, say, of a perfect fluid, to be able to write that down explicitly as a sum over particle trajectories, to really like understand what the equation of motion is, for example. That's what we're going to do today. Yeah, OK, right, right. I guess you have to pick and choose topics in a three-week format, right? So here's a basic fact about this number density current, which I was going to ask as a question. But if this definition is new, then that would be unfair. Is that it's always conserved. And you can show this directly from the formula. Covariantly conserved. If the world lines, with one loophole, which is that if the world lines are allowed to stop, which you can do if this is an arbitrary non-affine parameterization, right? I can make a world line run for a while and then let its position be constant in time. If world lines are allowed to end or just like trail off so slowly that they don't go off to infinity, then you would have some source on the right-hand side here. Otherwise, in ordinary situations, this is always covariantly conserved. And this is just sort of expressing the statement that if I have a closed surface, the total number of world lines in has to be the total number of world lines out. This number current is defined for like an ensemble of world lines, but it's not defined, say, for a field. If I had some scalar field, it doesn't make sense to ask what its number current is. Okay.
So I have a question. Do they have to be geodesics, or is it?
No, this is always true, even if the world lines aren't geodesics. You look skeptical. Oh, there's just some conservation law that says that if I have a closed surface, the number of world lines going in has to be the same as the number of world lines going out. So if I integrate, if world lines are not allowed to, start or end. So if I integrate around some codimension one surface, the normal to the surface times n mu, I always have to get zero. And that by Stokes' theorem is equivalent to covariant conservation. You can prove it from the definition of this definition. You can take the covariant derivative and prove it, although it's a little, the proof is actually a little convoluted. Okay, so what about the energy density rho? Let's say I have a an ensemble of particles. I freeze a constant time snapshot, and then I just sum the energies of each particle and count the energy per unit volume. What is that what covariant object is that a piece of? Yeah, so this is more familiar. This is a stress energy tensor. And this is defined more generally, like say for a set of fields, with specified action, you can define this. The stress energy tensor is more general than just something that's defined for a set of particle trajectories. Now here's sort of a covariant way of thinking about stress energy. If I have, again, a little piece of a little codimension one surface, infinitesimal, some normal vector and some three volume, then the, you know, I have some world lines crossing the surface. And I want to consider their four momentum flux. That is to say, I just sum over world lines crossing the surface. There, the four momentum on each world line evaluated at the crossing point, with a plus or minus here, depending on whether the world line is crossing. This has to be a little piece of oriented surface in the direction of the vector n mu, or in the opposite direction. Then, one way of thinking about the stress energy tensor is that it is the object, four momentum flux, let's call this f mu. Is that it's the object that you contract n with to get the four momentum flux. So in particular, we can sort of interpret the components, like the 0, 0 component of the stress energy. Well, if I take a constant time hypersurface, and then I ask about the energy flux through that surface, so, you know, I just sum over all world lines crossing a surface of constant time, I sum their energies. Then that's what this is, and that's the same thing as the energy density. Because the stress energy tensor is symmetric, you can sort of think of these off diagonals in two different ways. You can either think of the momentum flux through a constant time hypersurface, that is the momentum density, or you could imagine, that's if I guess think about this, or I could think about this guy with the indices reversed as saying, if I take a surface of constant x and then just ask about the momentum transport across the surface, the total, the energy transport across the surface, the total energy moving this way minus the total energy moving on world lines this way. And the fact that the stress energy tensor is symmetric says that that has to be the same thing. If I draw a surface through this room and ask, what's the energy transport across the surface, that's the same thing as the instantaneous momentum density. And then what I have in this here, the off-diagonal terms, well, let's separate those out and think of a pressure plus an anisotropic part. Imagine that this blackboard is a surface of constant time. So I guess this is going to be a 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time. So in a given surface of constant time in a given snapshot, imagine that I draw a little box. And I have some world lines going through the box. Then what TXX would be counting, let's say this is X and this is Y. So what TXX would be is it would be saying, if I look at this side of the box, if I look at the side whose normal vector is in the X direction, what is the total transport of momentum, of x momentum, through the side. And the way the signs work out, you always count it with a positive sign. If I have a world line going this way, then let's say I've oriented n this way. Then these are counted positively, and they have positive px. And likewise, something going this way would be counted with positive px. So what TXX would measure is it's sort of the, you know, pressure, the force that would be experienced. If I imagine making this like a reflective surface so that the particles bounce off, it's sort of the pressure that would be experienced on this face. Likewise, the YY component is sort of the pressure that would be you would experience in this face if the particles bounced off. So when we talk about pressure, we really mean some sort of isotropic average, which is why the trace of the space-space energy momentum tensor is what we intuitively think of as pressure. You know, if we have a confined, if we confine the particles in the box, then the trace, TXX plus TYY, is just the total pressure that has to be supplied to the summed over all sides of the box. And there's an anisotropic component, Txx minus Tyy is non-zero. If, say, there's sort of more pressure in this direction than in this direction, which is why we tend to think of the anisotropic stress as some sort of quadrupole in a phase-based distribution function. Likewise, Txy, you know, is non-zero if there's sort of a net tendency for particles to cross this way, if that's preferred over particles crossing this way, which is the same thing as saying that there's an anisotropic pressure if I rotate the box by 90 degrees. So the trace-free part of the stress-energy tensor is what you would think of as sort of an anisotropic pressure. Okay, so this is a nice covariant way of thinking about stress-energy. One thing that's counterintuitive is that, you know, for particles, for ensembles of particles, you always have positive pressure, but the stress-energy tensor of, well, let's say a scalar field, for example, in unperturbed FRW, looks like this. And so scalar fields with at positive energy densities tend to have negative pressure. Or same for a cosmological constant where the energy momentum is lambda minus lambda. Okay. And here's a covariant formula. If I again have a set of parameterized world lines, lambda is parameterized world lines, say n parameterized world lines, where and here the lambda really has to be the proper time. That's called tau. Proper time for a time-like trajectory or affine parameter for a light-like trajectory. That is to say, the parameterization such that the time derivative is the energy momentum for a vector. That defines the normalization of the time here. Then T mu nu is just given by this formula. I integrate a sum over particle trajectories. I integrate over proper time along the trajectory. I put the covariant delta function. Then I just have two powers of the four momentum here. It's not too hard to say that this definition corresponds to the way I defined it here. Okay. So do you guys have a guess for the circumstances under which this covariant derivative is zero? What's that? Not quite, because you know, you could imagine.
No source.
I think you're on the right track. So this is zero. If it can be shown generally that this is zero if the trajectories are geodesics. In general relativity, the covariant conservation of the stress energy, say for a field, that's something that is zero if the equations of motion of the field are satisfied, but can be non-zero off-shell if I just have some, you know, off arbitrary field configuration that doesn't leave the action stationary, and I compute the stress energy tensor for that configuration, it won't generally be conserved. Analogously, for an ensemble of particles, their stress energy, defined this way, is conserved if and only if the equations of motion of the particles are satisfied, that is to say, if they're geodesics in the metric.
That's not really true, right? I mean, particles can interact in being non-geodesic.
Oh yeah, that's right. So if I have multiple species, then it's not necessarily the case, if they interact, then it's not necessarily the case that the individual stress energies of the species are conserved. Oh yeah, that's right. So for say the, if I consider the stress energy tensor of all the free electrons in the universe, then it's not conserved because the photons are interact with the electrons.
So this TBU is the Einstein-Hilbert TBU that we know from, from their relativity. But what about the canonical energy momentum that you get from Goethe's principle, for example? Is there also a way to think about it as some kind of construction of particles? Because that guy is in general asymmetrical, right? So there is not necessarily symmetry.
Right. You know, I didn't work that out. That's an interesting question. I never tried to work that out. It must be the case that you can connect the definitions. Like if I have, if I write down an action where I have some set of fields plus some set of particle trajectories, if that's the action for the universe, and then I define the stress energy tensor in sort of the usual GR sense, this is the definition. So what's not clear from this discussion is how this definition of the stress energy tensor for a set of particle trajectories connects up with its more general definition in general relativity. You know this? I think that's what you're, that's one way of phrasing your question, right?
Is the same guy for the matter action? The matter action is just given by that.
It must be true. It must be the case that if I write down a matter action that consists of, say, an Einstein-Hilbert term, plus maybe a bunch of auxiliary fields if I wanted, plus some set of particle trajectories, then vary with respect to the inverse metric, it must be the case that I'll recover this stress energy tensor. But I didn't actually check that prior to the lecture. That would have been a good thing to check so that I could say that that was true with a clear conscience because I worked it out. Is that what you're asking?
Diffeomorphism invariants, you can always shift by some infinitesimal vector field, and then you can calculate what is the conserved quantity related to that thing.
Oh, right. So that definitely is, it's always the case that that is the same as this.
Plus the Lipantic part. Yeah, it can have an asymmetric part. Yeah. I was just wondering about the asymmetric part being understood in terms of some asymmetric stuff in terms of these trajectories, you know, like different perspectives.
Yeah, that's a good question. Where did the asymmetric part go here? That is a good question, and that's certainly something that I'll think about and work out the answer to the next time I give this a version of this lecture. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure. In fact, you can show if you take the covariant derivative here and do some delta function manipulations that, in general, the covariant divergence of the stress energy tensor defined this way is given by this formula, which is fairly intuitive. Where this is an object with one index now, and so what appears is the second derivative of the particle trajectories. Where I've used the capital D to emphasize that in order to compute the second derivative of a particle trajectory, I need a connection. So this is the quantity that would be zero for a geodesic, by definition. So the second covariant derivative is what you think of as the change in the energy momentum of each particle due to an applied force. So this equation is just saying that the divergence of the stress energy tensor, or if you want the derivative of the energy of the total energy momentum, is just like the total force density that's been applied to the particles. Right. It keeps getting hidden behind the podium. I'll just move it to the top. Okay, so we're about to, in the next few lectures, we're going to model the universe as the sum of three fluids. A fluid that represents baryonic matter, a fluid that represents cold dark matter, and a fluid that represents photons. In first order perturbation theory. So this is an approximation. Fluid means that I treat each species as if the only quantities that were dynamically important were its stress energy tensor. Now, as you can see, the stress energy tensor is giving you like the second moments, all the quadrupole moments, including the time quadrupole moments with the time index of the particle density. That is not a complete description. In general, to fully describe a species late in the universe after a bunch of free streaming has taken place, you would need to keep all moments or equivalently like a full phase-based distribution function. For example, to describe today at redshift zero, the statistics of the CMB, well, the CMB has anisotropy out to L of 2000 or so. So we would need to keep moments. The stress energy tensor is just keeping moments out to L equals 2. We would need to keep moments out to L of 2000. But in the early universe, this is a good approximation. When things are sort of tightly coupled together into a plasma, only the fluid degrees of freedom are important. And if we had more time, we'd go beyond this approximation and put in many moments of the phase-based distributions, that is, go beyond the fluid approximation and consider what's called the Boltzmann hierarchy, but we won't have time. I will also make the approximation. I'll also neglect anisotropic stress, so I'll say that the fluids are perfect fluids. Anisotropic stress. You'll also notice that neutrinos have been left out, even though neutrinos are very interesting cosmologically. It's just not really possible to describe them in this approximation because, the perfect fluid approximation is accurate at time in situations where free streaming is not dynamically important. And neutrinos start free streaming right from the very beginning, so they're really not very well described by the degrees of freedom of a fluid. The dynamical quantities will be the perfect fluid degrees of freedom of each species. So each species is going to have a background density rho j and mean pressure pj, where j is either b for baryon, c for cold dark matter, or gamma for photon. Fluctuations, these are dynamical quantities that will have equations of motion. Delta rho j, bj, delta pj. For a fluid which is assumed perfect, these five numbers specify its stress energy tensor. Part of the reason why I talked about this general picture is to make things like statements like this apparent. So for the baryons in the cold dark matter, the pressure fluctuation is zero. And that is the case because for non-relativistic particles, if you look at this formula for the stress energy tensor of an ensemble of particle trajectories, then the space-space part of the stress energy tensor for a non-relativistic particle is always of order v squared over c squared. And because we're computing to first order in perturbation theory, then this means that, you know, this is a second order quantity. We'll just neglect it. Now, another thing that's true for photons, there's a formula for the pressure fluctuation in terms of the density fluctuation, which follows from this fact that the trace of the stress energy tensor of photons is always equal to zero. Now, does anyone see offhand why that's true? This is actually generally true for massless particles. Anything massless, and in fact, it's true whether the particles are moving on geodesics or not. I guess that's apparent because there are no derivatives of the stress energy tensor involved. The way that I see that this is true, there must be some nice symmetry way of seeing this is true. This does sort of look like what you would get if you changed the, just shifted the metric by a conformal factor. But a sort of blue-collar way of seeing why this is true is to say that if you take this expression for the stress energy tensor, contract it with g mu nu, and bring the g mu nu inside the sum, then I'm just contracting the g mu nu against two copies of the instantaneous four momentum of the photon, and that's just zero because it's moving on a null trajectory. So to translate this into a formula for delta p, let me remind you that for a perfect fluid, So an inefficient thing to do would be to look back at our expression for the perfect fluid stress energy in terms of these quantities and just contract it with the perturbed FRW metric. But a nicer way to do it is to remember that our parameterization was set up so that the stress energy tensor has this covariant form. Where u is the bulk four velocity of the fluid. Let's say where this is true, and rho is rho bar plus delta rho, p is p bar plus delta p. We showed in an earlier lecture that if I take this expression and expand rho and p to first order like this, expand the metric to first order in the fluctuations, that's how we motivated our expansion of the stress energy tensor in terms of fluctuations. So if I just start here and contract with g mu nu, so this has to equal zero. Then I get minus rho plus p plus 4p, or minus rho plus 3p. And then if I write that as a background average plus fluctuations, then this quantity is zero in the background. So I find that the pressure fluctuation in the fluid is 1/3 the density fluctuation. That's just the condition that the trace of the stress energy tensor be equal to zero? Written out in our perturbative expansion.
Can you delete this one a little bit? Because mu is supposed to be the four velocity in the rest frame of the fluid. And I mean, there is a photon which doesn't have a rest frame. So, I mean, how can I think about this? I mean, we have a photon.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So what the photon, what the rest frame of the photon fluid means is it's the frame where you don't see any net dipole in the photon fluid. For example, you know, today we have a CMB dipole, which is of order 10 to the minus 3 in a particular direction. And that is, by definition, the bulk velocity of the photon fluid. Of course, the individual photons making up the fluid move at the speed of light, but their bulk velocity is non-relativistic. It's of it's a first-order quantity in perturbation theory, so it's of order 10 to the minus 5. Now, this formula is what you would have guessed if you had just perturbed you know, the background FRW metric. The radiation part of the FRW background has a pressure that's equal to 1/3 of its density. So you might think that you could just sort of delta both sides and get this expression. But it's not. Let me just as a comment say that it's not generally true, just for some general component of the stress energy. That if I have a component of the stress energy where P bar is equal to W rho in the background, that doesn't generally imply that the fluctuations are related the same way. And a counterexample is single field inflation. Where we worked out formulas for both P bar over rho bar in single field inflation, and we also worked out formulas for delta P and delta rho. And if you compare them, you'll see that they're, you know, just not the same. This is, you know, minus 1 plus some slow roll corrections. And this is kind of a big mess that involves derivatives of the potential. Not generally true. So the dynamical degrees of freedom are just the density fluctuations and the rest frame velocities of all three of these species. And the total stress energy appearing in Einstein's equations will be well. When I write rho bar, I mean the sum of all the rho bars of the species, and likewise for the pressure. And then if I add up the stress energy tensors, I get these expressions. So the total delta rho. If I don't put the J suffix, I mean the total. Is the sum of the delta rho's, the delta p is the sum of the delta p's, and the quantity rho bar plus p bar, the way the velocities add is like this. You average them with rho bar plus p bar weighting. So the photons get a weighting of 4/3 because their equation of state is 1/3 relative to what you might naively expect. This is just because this rule for adding up the individual stress energy fluctuations to get the total stress energy fluctuation of the universe, it just follows from the fact that the stress energy tensors add. If you look at our formula for T0i in terms of the fluctuations, you'll see that there's always a rho bar plus p bar attached to the velocity. So in other words, you don't add the velocities or average the velocities, you add the stress energy tensors. And it's a consequence of the way our definitions are constructed that the velocity enters the stress energy weighted by a factor of rho plus p. So this tends to kind of trip me up in calculations, so I thought I'd say so explicitly. One final definition. Rather than use delta rho j, it's convenient to keep track of the fractional overdensity. So this is just a little change of variables. The equations are simpler if you express everything in terms of the density fluctuation divided by its spatial average. So the dynamical quantities here are going to be the scalars delta rho j, the three vectors vij, plus the degrees of freedom of the metric. The equations of motion for the metric are Einstein's equations, but we're going to need equations of motion for the fluid degrees of freedom. And so I'm going to start deriving that. It's sort of useful. We're going to fix the gauge soon, but it's sort of useful to have a formula that applies in an arbitrary perturbed FRW gauge. So schematically, the equation of motion simply says that the divergence of the stress energy tensor of each fluid is equal to like a force term, which is just adding up the total change in form momentum per unit volume over all particles in the fluid. Let's work out the left-hand side. Both the left-hand side and the right-hand side of this equation take some calculation to get. So this is schematically. Let's start with the left-hand side. Let me consider the case where the index nu is equal to 0. On the formula sheet, actually, I don't think this is quite what's on the formula sheet. What I wrote on the formula sheet is the form of the continuity equation for a conserved stress energy tensor, which is just the requirement that this be equal to 0. So if I take that equation and move everything over to one side to get 0 on the other side, then this is, and of course you can just derive this from our expression for the stress energy tensor in terms of the fluid degrees of freedom and our expression for Christoffel symbols. But let me skip that part of the calculation and just take as a starting point the fact that this is the general formula for, this is the zero component of the divergence of the stress energy in an arbitrary FRW gauge. And then I just want to simplify a little bit. So I'm going to write this term as I'm just going to make some minor simplifications to express this in terms of the overdensity delta j. I'm also going to relate the pressure fluctuations to the density fluctuations. So let me write this term for each of our three fluids. So this delta pj was 0 for the baryons in the dark matter, and it was 1/3 delta rho j for the photons. So for each of our three components, this is equal to the equation of state of the component times delta rho j. So I'll write this term this way. Rho j bar delta j. And likewise, I have a 1 plus wj here, bar j. The derivative of rho j bar, well, rho j bar falls off proportionally to a to the minus 3 times 1 plus w, which means that if I differentiate it, I have to get the same thing back with this exponent in front times an h. If I differentiate this, I get a minus 3. If I differentiate the rho j bar, I get this plus a term from differentiating the delta j. There's this big cancel. There's this cancellation. This is why it's convenient to use delta j instead of delta rho j. At the end of the day, I end up with this. Let me pull the rho j bar up. This is just, I'm just going through the steps here to get you accustomed to the definitions. So that's the left-hand side of the equation of motion for the time component when the index nu is equal to 0. And I'm going to give, as a homework problem, the case of doing the spatial components. Which gives this. I wrote this one with a lowered index. A similar calculation. Gives this result. A little longer. All right. So the left-hand sides of the equations of motion of the fluids are going to look like this. But there will be source terms on the right-hand side from interactions between the species. Now, for the dark matter, we're actually done. The dark matter, we're assuming, doesn't interact with anything. So the equation of motion for the dark matter would just be given by taking wj equal to 0 and setting both of these guys to 0. That would give a a couple of first order differential equations, one for what equation for delta j dot and an equation for vj dot. For the baryons and photons, things are more complicated. So they interact by Compton scattering. Which Thompson scattering is just E minus gamma to E minus gamma scattering in the non-relativistic limit. That is one way of saying it is in the rest frame of the electron. The energy of the photon is much less than the electron mass. So the sort of classic Thompson cross-section can be written like this. So in the rest frame of the baryon fluid, the differential cross-section per unit solid angle is given by this. The 3 over 8 pi squared is so that the integral of this over all angles will give sigma t. So can we translate this? Right-hand sides to the equations of motion and finish the calculation. What I'm going to do is analyze in normal coordinates for the collision in the rest frame of the electrons. And then try to translate the result back to the perturbed FRW coordinate system. What the rest frame of the E minus means is that the baryon 4 velocity can be taken to be this. And what normal coordinates means is that the metric can be taken to be this. Sorry, ones. So that I can just forget about the expanding universe and just say that I'm doing special relativity. So in this coordinate system, let NE be the free electron density. So that is something that I forgot to say that Thompson scattering is dominated by the electrons, the contribution, the free electrons, the contribution from the free protons or helium nuclei is negligibly small because this cross section has some power of the electron, some negative power of the electron mass in it. But I forgot whether it's minus one or minus two, but it's suppressed by the proton to electron mass ratio. So this quantity is something that starts out large in the hot Big Bang, redshift says 1 over a cubed, and then falls to 0 at recombination when the free electrons all get tied up into neutral hydrogen atoms. Let rho gamma Maybe the photon energy density? I'll let V gamma be the photon bulk velocity, so the photon fluid would have some bulk velocity that looks like this. And then let's let pi be the photon momentum density. Which is, and this is the part of the calculation that I think it's possible to screw up, is equal to this. If the photons were non-relativistic, then their momentum density would be their energy density times v. But for photons, the total momentum density of the fluid is equal to four-thirds times its energy density times its bulk velocity, where the bulk velocity, you know, can be defined as the boost that you need to apply to make the distribution look isotropic. So why four-thirds? This is really non-obvious, but it follows from the fact that the stress energy tensor, so the photon momentum density, remember that's really T0i. And for a perfect fluid, the stress energy tensor looks like this. U plus P plus P G mu. Right, so to first order in U in these normal coordinates, I'm going to have a P down here. I'm going to have a rho plus P V here. And I'm going to have a rho here. And so this is really rho gamma plus P gamma times V. That's the correct expression for the 0i component of the stress energy tensor, where for photons, this is 1/3 rho gamma. You could also just verify directly that if I have an isotropic distribution of photon momenta, of null vectors, and I apply a boost with velocity v in special relativity, that you end up with a factor of 4/3 here when you sum their momenta. Okay. I have to stop in the middle of the calculation. We did the subtle part, I think, which is seeing this factor of 4/3. The rest is pretty straightforward, but we'll do it tomorrow.
When we think about the conservation law of energy momentum, the covariant conservation law, on the right-hand side should strictly always be zero. But if we think about perturbations, then we can put something, right? Is that the reason?
One constraint that has to be satisfied is that the right-hand side, there's going to be a right-hand side for the variant and a right-hand side for the photon fluid, and they have to be, you know, the negative of each other.
But if you solve, because we're doing perturbation theory, but if you solve the Einstein equations exactly, say for some fluids, then this should be an exact equality, right? T mean U should be exactly divergence free, or should there be still some right hand side?
Well, the total stress energy of the universe is always exactly divergence free. But for an individual species, that's...
Okay, so yeah.